I'd like to introduce our last speaker of this afternoon session and thank the Harlow B. Rigby Charitable Trust for sponsoring this session, this speaker, Dr. Brent James. Dr. Brent James is going to speak to us on an update on the status of American medicine. Dr. James is known internationally for his work in clinical quality improvement, patient safety, and the infrastructure that underlies successful improvement efforts such as cultural change, data systems, payment methods, and management roles. He is a member of the National Academy of Science Institutes of Medicine and has participated in many of that organization's seminal works on quality and patient safety. Dr. James is a fellow of the American College of Physician Executives. He holds faculty appointments at the University of Utah School of Medicine, Harvard School of Public Health, and University of Sydney Australia School of Public Health. He is currently Chief Quality Officer and Executive Director of the Institute for Healthcare Delivery Research at Intermountain Healthcare. James has been honored with a series of awards for quality in healthcare delivery, including the prestigious Demi Cup from Columbia University School of Business in 2011. For many years, he has been named among Modern Physicians' 50 most influential physician executives in healthcare. He has also been named among the 100 most powerful people in healthcare reform for over 7 years and the top 25 clinical informaticists by Modern Healthcare. Before working for Intermountain Healthcare, he was an assistant professor in the Department of Biostatistics at the Harvard School of Public Health and staffed the American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer. He presently serves on several nonprofit boards of trustees dedicated to clinical improvement. Help me welcome Dr. James.
Thank you and good afternoon. I'm the last thing between you and hopefully a wonderful weekend, I suspect. I'm surprised how many people actually stuck around, in all frank truth. I'll try to keep it interesting. This is going to be, at least from my perspective, a fairly challenging topic. Some of you may know more about it than I. I was asked to comment on the current status of American medicine, and I thought to do it in a particular way. The best way I know to introduce that, if I can find the slide advancer. Ah, there it is. I see it. I spent most of the spring of 2009 in Washington, D.C. I was asked to testify twice to the Senate Finance Committee. Those are the guys who actually control health policy for the nation. Senate Finance, Orrin Hatch currently chairs it. Once to Ted Kennedy's Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, once to the money guys on the House side, House Ways and Means. More than that, I spent literally weeks of time with the senior staff of those committees. That's where the action happens. They identify the issues, they debate it out, they actually write the legislation. We had two issues on the table. The first was roughly 46 million people in this country that had no health insurance. Just wrong. That the richest economy in the world would have that holding true. The second was more profound. Healthcare costs had been increasing dramatically over time. Back in 1960, they consumed 6% of the national wealth. By this point, we're at about 15%. Oh, today it's just under 18%. And it continues to grow at double-digit rates. The trouble is if we expanded insurance and didn't somehow address the cost issues, I argued at least it'd be like pouring gasoline on the fire. We were going to end up with a true crisis down the road if we didn't address that somehow. Let's just say that our political leadership had no appetite for eating their vegetables. They, as usual, wanted to go straight to dessert, expand an entitlement program. What we got in, well, some people call it Obamacare. I object to that term. What we got in the PPACA, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, was almost all insurance reform, expanding insurance accessibility. And we've seen an effect. The proportion of uninsured fell from about 16% of all patients to about 10% today. Now, there are issues with it. Most of the exchange programs are high-deductible plans. Most of the people who buy them don't have enough out-of-pocket cash to pay their deductibles. And it's not clear if the insurance is working as well as we had hoped, but we can say that we did decrease the number of people who were without insurance. You know, I found this great quote. This fellow's name is Alan Antoven. He's justifiably famous. Alan's an economist, now a professor emeritus at Stanford University. he made this statement the day after the ACA passed, which is what makes it interesting. Here's what he said. He said, you know, the United States does not have decades to wait for health system reform. So he kicked it off. Well, wait a minute, Alan. We passed the ACA yesterday. What in the world do you mean? Well, he went on to explain himself. In 2009, he said about $1.15 trillion of the federal budget was spent on health care. Federal government covers a little bit more than half of all health care expenditures in the country. And health care expenditures are growing 2.7% per year faster than non-health care gross domestic product. It was growing to consume more and more of our national wealth, pulling money out of education, out of infrastructure, out of retirement, out of a whole series of important social programs. Yeah, he went on to say, the current reform bill does practically nothing to slow health expenditures. Truer thing was never said. Now, why is that a problem? It has to do not just with the deficit, but with something called the fiscal gap. The fiscal gap is the difference year over year of the money that the federal government brings in, primarily through taxation. There are some other sources as well, but primarily taxation, and their outgo, their expenditures. And we project that over time. We adjust for population growth, demographic shifts, but we can project how much their commitments are going to cost, how much their income is likely to be. These statistics are the most conservative that I could find. They're the ones I actually used with Senate Finance at the time. They come from the Government Accounting Office. It only covers people who were alive in 2009. People born after are not included, but it does do it through their entire life for everybody alive in 2009. Yeah, everything up through that lower orange line, the thin orange line, that's the federal deficit at the time. The reason that young people should not be too reliant on Social Security. It turns out that program, despite consuming about 13% of all wages and salaries in the United States, 6.5% on your pay stub, 6.5% in matching funds from your employer, it's a fairly good stream of funding. Despite that, that program is $7.7 trillion short of meeting its obligations for people alive in 2009. Roughly the same size as a top bar, the Aqua bar. That's Medicare Part D, the drug benefit, a mere $7.2 trillion shortfall. Now, that's not the spend. That's just the shortfall. You see, that's the gap piece. The big guy, the big orange chunk, is payment to physicians for services, Medicare Part B, $17.2 trillion shortfall. The gray bar, Part A, that's the hospital trust fund, a mere $13.8 trillion. If you total it all up, it's $60 trillion. Now, this is the most conservative that I was able to find. Probably the most respected analyst in Washington then, he retired 3 years ago. He ran the Office of the Actuary at CMS, a guy named Foster. He says the real number was about twice that, about $120 trillion. For people alive in 2009. Now, if you do it right, if you include expected birth rates after 2009, you do something called a net present value. The government was $211 trillion in the hole. $211 trillion, that's a big number. How do you interpret that? Well, the best way I can think of, the current value of the United States of America, the whole country, all public and private property, either physical property or intellectual property. Your homes, your cars, this building, the slide advancer, my tie, all of it. About $75 trillion. Technically, the government of the United States is bankrupt. The joke is not just politically and morally, but financially. All right? And that's the sad financial truth. Interestingly, there's very little debate about this in any setting. The best answer I've ever heard given to it is it will somehow muddle through, as we have in the past. But it's frankly quite sobering, you see. Oh, the real problem, did you notice that roughly two-thirds of the uncovered spend is health care? The size of the bubbles are accurate. These are updated for 2014 as opposed to 2009. But about two-thirds of their spending problem is healthcare delivery. Now, guys, this has an interpretation. if you think financial pressures on healthcare have been bad in the past, you ain't seen nothing yet. There's a financial reality that lies behind this, and it's just going to get worse and worse and worse looking ahead. That's a sad conclusion that you're forced to derive from these data. Again, among those who study it, there's no debate. I keep trying to find someone who'll fight with me about this. A good fight would give you a little bit of hope. I haven't found anybody in any setting who disagrees with the fundamental numbers. If you feel like you're at ground zero and the missiles are kind of in the air, if you feel like you have a target painted on the top of your head, that's the right feeling. Now, in the ACA, it expanded insurance. President Obama had asked us to limit additional deficit spending directly attributable to the law to $1 trillion in additional spending, uncovered spending, through 2020. That was a request. You know, it costs money to expand insurance. The government didn't have the money, $1 trillion. Well, they did it through three primary mechanisms to limit it to $1 trillion. The total cost was actually substantially higher. Number one, the highest tax rate in about 50 years, tax rate increase. It's in a series of small taxes. So, for example, if you have health insurance, you now pay taxes on your health insurance, a small tax on your health insurance to buy other people's health insurance. Another piece, the device tax at 3% of total gross revenues, very controversial. There are a whole series of them, 17 or 18 of them in total. And that supplied some of the coverage so that it limited it to $1 trillion in deficit spend. The second thing was fairly classic Washington smoke and mirrors. The insurance expansion happened in 2014, but the other elements happened in 2010. It means that you had 10 years of income against 6 years of spend. All right? And that's how they accounted it. It meant that if you followed it out in 2020 when it went on year over year accounting, there was this hockey stick effect in the deficit. And they were just pushing it out into the future. The third one, though, is the most important one for us today. With no visible means of support, by and large, they just assumed that they were going to pay you and me substantially less for the same services. They were going to cut payment rates to physicians and hospitals. All right? Again, this comes from the Office of the Actuary. It's a little study done back in 2012. This shows hospital payments under the PPACA. Now, the dashed line at the top, that's commercial insurance payments as expected into the future. It's a rough, good estimate of the cost of operating a hospital or a practice. All right? With a reasonable operating margin to keep you financially whole. Truth is, it has a certain amount of cost shifting going on with it, of shifting money off federal programs onto commercial insurers. It's probably a little elevated for that purpose. It's a hidden tax. What they expect, though, is that payments to hospitals were going to decline on a per-case basis, and you can get some sense of the way that line declines. That's what they needed to make the budget balance, and so they just wrote it in, that those payments would decline. They didn't specify exactly how it would decline. CMS has been working on that since. This is a nice little summary slide put together by some folks up at Avera Health. They listed the things that CMS has proposed to reduce payments. Now, here's the funny thing. I specialize in quality, clinical quality. These are all billed as quality measures, but their net impact is to reduce payment. When you look at the measurement systems they're using for some of these quality measures, they're so specious, just so completely inane, that you quickly realize this has nothing to do with real quality. This all has to do with payment and maintaining a political patina, surface antigens, to make it politically acceptable. You see what I mean? So, for example, last year they established something called hospital-acquired conditions, complications that patients face when they're hospitalized. The law actually explicitly states that one quarter of the hospitals in the country will get a 1% drop in their total Medicare payment. That way the CBO could account it properly. A 1% drop in total Medicare payments. From that one alone, for 25% of the hospitals, the bottom 25 every year. Pat Conway, a pretty good guy, their CMO, put together a measurement system Their measurement system has a true positive rate to identify low performance of 5.8%. And a gold standard independent evaluation. It has a false positive rate of 50%. Would you consider using a lab test that had a true positive rate of 6% and a false positive rate of 50%? That's what they're using. You see, now Patrick's a pretty good guy, actually. He used the political process to choose the measures, and when some of us applied the science and pointed out how badly it worked, he, of course, defended the administration, but then went back to try to find something better. They're still struggling to find something better. Unfortunately, it's not risk-adjusted. The hospitals who get hit are those with a higher index of severity, particularly academic medical centers are disproportionately represented. Hospitals that serve underserved populations, disproportionately represented. But it's the way the Congress could book out a 1% cut in Medicare payments. You get the idea? Now, for hospitals, if you total the whole thing up, it comes to 9.75% reduction in Medicare payments. Is what it comes out to, assuming that you did poorly on all of them. Most will not. This year, though, for example, on readmission rates, well over 70% of the hospitals in this country will be penalized financially on readmission rates, and I would suggest to you, when you have 70% of the performers, some awfully good hospitals in there, can't meet their standard, that raises issues about the standard. You see, it's kind of sobering, isn't it? Boy, I'm being depressive today about this stuff. Oh, let's get it closer to home. This is the same figure for physician payments that the law assumed. Now, you might see a rather dramatic drop there at the first, all of a sudden, Medicare payments drop to the level of Medicaid payments. That's called the sustainable growth rate. I'm just going to assume that all of you knew what the sustainable growth rate was. Just a little bit of background on it. It was passed by Congress in 1998. The guys who passed it wanted a certain length of time so that they wouldn't be blamed when it cut in. Not kidding here, so 5-year lag by law into the thing. It limited Medicare Part B payments, those are professional fee payments. The rates of increase that were allowed at a population level, a national level, had to match growth of the gross domestic product so that fees to physicians couldn't grow faster than the nation's ability to pay, which kind of makes sense, you'd have to admit. However, in the ensuing years, 17 separate occasions across the next 11 years, they kicked the can down the road. It was due to come into play. It accumulated over time, by the way. It accumulated. And as it was due to come into play, they postponed it each time. Why would they do that? Well, what would happen to your practice if they cut your payments for Medicare patients by 23%? Which was the accumulated size of it at the time this analysis was done, what would happen? Well, the short answer is we'd have a whole bunch of patients out in our communities that had an insurance card, they had Medicare, they just wouldn't have a physician. Now, most of us would not have dropped out of Medicare. Some do, but most don't. We use scheduling to work around it. We say, here's how many Medicare patients our practice can maintain, and well, if it's a nice, well-paid commercial patient, we can see him tomorrow. Oh, my next available slot for Medicare is out 2 months. Technically, just in passing, that's illegal. In terms of the conditions of participation in Medicare, nobody enforces it. And it happens on a fairly routine basis. We see for-profit hospitals in this state do it relative to hospitalizations with Medicare as well, on a fairly regular basis. That's how it would play out. That's why they kicked the can down the road. Of course, this became a real sore point for most physicians. A lot of pushback around the sustainable growth rate. You do see that curve, don't you? The idea is that by 2020, Medicare would be paying below current Medicaid payment rates for physician services. That's how they balance the budget. You see, right there. Well, and there was a big political backlash, and we started to talk about the doc fix. Technically, House of Representatives Bill 2, its full name is the Medicare Access and CHIP, that's Children's Health Insurance Program, Special Insurance for Children Reauthorization Act, also known as MACRA. You've probably heard that term, MACRA. It passed Congress on April 16, 2015. President Obama signed it into law shortly thereafter. Now, they've done the same trick. Its first implementation is in 2019, January 1st, 2019, is when the main elements in that law goes live. So this is looking at our future. It, first of all, replaced SGR. So the doc fix got rid of the old sustainable growth rate formula. It cost to implement it because that 23% drop, everybody in government accounting just assumed that that was going to happen because it was in the law. Cost $205 billion over the next 11 years to deploy it. Interestingly, they found about $64 billion in funding for it. The other $141 billion went on to the national debt to cover it. Despite the rhetoric from the Republicans in Congress, they passed it through to the national debt in large part. Now, it has some secondary things in it besides eliminating the sustainable growth rate. It streamlines and combines a series of quality measures that are currently imposed upon clinical practice, and I'll come back and list those, the main ones, in just a moment. But it also shifts the payment mechanisms looking ahead, starting in 2015. We're going to talk about two of them. There are two that it explicitly lists, and they're down there at the bottom. The first is called merit-based incentive payment systems. That's fee-for-service in the future. MIPS is what it's called in short. Then it proposes something called alternative payment model, or APM. Before we get into the details of them, I thought I just might show you the financial impact of that legislation. So in this case, the black line at the top, labeled MEI, that's a medical expense index. That's where things that have to be to maintain a practice, basically. Assuming that you're not cost shifting onto commercial, which does happen. Now the blue line that starts at the very left and drops rather rapidly, that was payments to physicians under the ACA. And that big initial drop was the sustainable growth rate kicking in. You see, and then it continued to move things down from there. So that's the Washington smoke and mirrors to get the ACA funded by reducing payments to the physician part. It was actually a slightly larger reduction to hospitals, by the way, just in passing. Red line, forget that one, that's not useful. Under MACRA, payments to physicians is the green line. All right. So I don't know, you can take a look at that. The difference between the two lines is $205 billion. I don't know, do you feel like you've been made whole when you look at the two lines? Do you feel like your future's really been changed in a significant way when you look at those two lines? They actually cross, but it's not out until about 2050, well in the future. A can that goes well down the road. Now, I've been known to go around saying that this is a doc fix that wasn't a fix. I predict it's just going to be a short while before it becomes a major political problem again. Even though it slows the rate of decreases, it still assumes those rates of decreases. Well, that's the first part. Let's go back, though, and revisit the two programs, give you some sense of how they work. Maybe you're already familiar with MIPS and APMs. It is our future, at least under the current federal law. So what it did was combine three main programs for quality measurement, what's called Physician Quality Reporting System, where we're required to report clinical measures for Medicare patients to the federal government, PQRS. You're probably all familiar with meaningful use for electronic health records and the requirements that those imposed. It includes that as well. And finally, what's called the value-based payment modifier. So another quality modifier to payment based upon quality performance. So it combines them together. And that's the core starting in the back. Now, in 2019, when the plan kicks in, it says that annual rate increases for physicians in that year for both MIPS and APM is 0.5%, one half of one percentage point rate increase for our services. Then, between 2020 and 2026, in MIPS, there are no further rate increases. All right? Technically, there aren't in APM either. But you see down at the bottom, I put that plus 5%. They give a 5% bonus to basic pay rates to anybody who selects an APM. So if you go APM side, you get a 5% higher payment rate. Now, that program expires in 2026. All right, it doesn't go beyond that. And very clearly, it's a statement by the federal government that they want to drive all physicians into APMs, mostly by making historic fee-for-service, the MIPS program, very, very financially unattractive. It's a short way of saying that. In fact, going forward after that point, after 2026, the annual rate increases are assumed to be for MIPS 0.25%, 0.25%. For APMs, it's three times higher, 0.75%. So that's the basic structure comparing the two approaches, fee-for-service versus APMs. Now, it turns out we're not done with MIPS at that point. They do another thing too. It's required to be budget neutral, and it's based on a quality scoring system. Those three systems that I just listed for quality scoring, the details aren't out yet. In theory, CMS is to publish them in June of this year as an initial set of proposed regulations, and that will go through the regulatory cycle. It'll take them a couple of years to get them nailed down. It's a 0 to 100 scoring mechanism that includes PQRS, the Physician Quality Reporting System, so specific clinical measures. It includes meaningful use and EHR use parameters. It includes value-based payment pieces, all rolled together into one. For the poorest performers in 2019, it's a 4% decrease in your payment rate. In 2015, that goes up, I think, to 5%. In 2020, it goes up to 5%. In 2021, it's 7%. In 2022, it's as much as a 9% decrease in your fee-for-service payment rate for the services you provide. Those who do well on the score, they believe will be to the tops of the solid arrows. You could get a plus 4%, a plus 5%, a plus 7%, a plus 9%. The law explicitly states that it has to be budget neutral, so whatever they penalize one bunch of physicians has to go to another bunch of physicians. And the law explicitly allows as many as a threefold increase in the upside rate to make it budget neutral. And those are the dashed lines that gives the peak of how much they can put on the positive side to counteract the punishments they put on the negative side. So see how that works? Moderately complex, but hopefully I've reduced it to a simple graphic that it makes at least a little bit clear. Now, the way the scoring system actually comes together, it changes over time. In 2019, when it first goes live, well, every year, 25% of your score is based upon using electronic health records in the way that they prescribe. The blue chunk, that's if you do clinical practice improvement, quality improvement within your practice. I have no idea how they're going to measure that. They don't either, so far as I can tell, but they're going to put together some sort of a system for it. That's always 15% across the years. The red is your actual cost of care. So the cost of care for the patients you treat compared to other physicians treating similar patients with some sort of risk adjustment system. Again, details to be forthcoming. And then finally, the green is quality measures, clinical quality measures. And what you see happens is over time, each year, the proportion that depends on cost goes up and the proportion that depends on quality comes down. Until finally in steady state, 2021 and thereon, if I make that right, it's 25% goes into EHR, 15% goes into quality improvement within your practice, and I think it's 30% apiece for quality and cost. But that's how the scores are constructed to determine who gets the as much as 9% penalties and probably as much as 9% benefits based upon how well people do in those systems. So that's what's contained within the law. In the macro law. This is a doc fix, by the way. This is what they passed as part of the doc fix, you see. This is what fee-for-service by law is going to turn into. Now, there is an alternative, and that's called, an APM. To understand APMs, you have to understand that it has two pieces. First of all, if you're going to participate, you have to belong to an eligible APM. So far as I can tell, it's fairly poorly defined. A group of physicians or a group of care deliverers coming together in some way apply to the federal government, this is for Medicare, to be an eligible APM. And there's a certain amount of negotiation involved. What the law says is that the eligibility has to include quality measures comparable to MIPS. So the same sorts of quality measures, but now within the context of your own group. All right? Not against a direct federal system. It has to have similar use of certified electronic health record technologies, but again, within the context of your own group and how you choose to set it up, as opposed to just to the federal standards that come out. But they have to be acceptable to CMS to participate. And finally, you have to either use a CMMI, that's the Center for Medicare Services Innovation Body. You have to have a CMMI certified medical home, or you have to have what's called in the law more than nominal risk for financial losses. What it's anticipating is moving you toward capitated payment, where you take financial upside and financial downside based upon your own performance. But that's the first thing that you have to have to run an APM. You have to have that eligibility piece and the list criteria by which you'd be eligible. You have to have a qualified APM. Now, in addition to that, it mandates that you have to have your revenues at risk so that you are on the financial hook for your care consumption decisions that you make with your patients. That's number two on the list. And it lists minimum levels of all receipts in your practice that have to be tied to the eligible APM. Now, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to break it into two big subcategories. The first are called a qualifying participant. The second is called a partial qualifying participant. Here's what the difference is between a qualifying participant and a partially qualifying participant. A qualifying participant meets the things on the left. They get the 5% bonus, all right, if you're qualifying. You get the 5% overall bonus, 5% upside for participating in the program. Partially qualifying, less of your practice is at risk, and I'll give you the numbers in just a sec, but you don't get the 5% bonus. The reason they believe that a lot of people will want to do that is it means you're not part of MIPS. You can get out of MIPS if you're at least partially qualifying, and they believe that a lot of people will want to do that because they've made it fairly noxious, frankly, moving ahead. We'll see how it plays out, I guess. Well, a qualifying participant, you can qualify either on the basis of Medicare alone, or if you choose to, you could say a combination of your Medicare book of business within your practice, or within your, technically within your APM, it's probably going to be a group of physicians, alongside other payers. And so sometimes they call that all payer, Medicare plus commercial. So we get the Medicare only column, we get the all payer column. And it changes year over year. So in 2019, 2020, I'm going to have to put on my glasses to read my own slide here. Yeah. You have to have 25%, if it's Medicare only, so 25% of your Medicare practice has to be at financial risk as part of the APM as a minimum. If you go all payer, you still have to have 25% of Medicare. I'm sorry, in that year it doesn't qualify, it doesn't count. You can't be all payer in that year. In 2021, 2022, it increases to 50% of all of your Medicare practice to be Medicare only. In 2023 and forward, going from that time, it has to be 75% of all of your Medicare practice. It has to be the APM. It's a capitated plan, basically, where you're paid a capitated rate per patient, like Medicare Advantage, but to the provider of care. On the all-payer side, it kicks in 2021. You can still be at 25% Medicare, but then your entire practice has to be at 50% at financial risk. And by 2023, you can be 25% Medicare, but then 75% of your total practice. So it's a little complex. But what they're doing is pushing people into care delivery arrangements, at least for Medicare, where you're paid on a capitated basis. And they're trying to make it financially attractive to move in that direction. Okay? So that describes the rest of the doc fix. Do you feel fixed? You know? Because that's what the law says and that's what's coming out. Just out of curiosity, show of hands, how many of you are already familiar with this? How many of you had already encountered it or been through it? Yeah, not many. People are just starting to get the word. anything you'd change for those of you who've seen it? I think I got the details right. It's moderately complex, and I was trying to simplify it down to the point where it was at least approachable. Comments or changes from anybody? So this is the federally funded Medicare program, looking ahead under the current law. You see? Now, believe it or not, this actually has some real potential. Well, I wanted to first mention, this is a little out of date. This is a year old. It was January of 2015. What it shows is they've surveyed different groups to say how many of you are looking at moving into that very rapidly. And they broke it out by hospitals, health systems, integrated systems like an Intermountain or a Mountain Star or a university health system, and finally, physician organizations. And it turns out that the rate of change of organizations pulling into this model is actually fairly rapid. A lot of groups, mostly through their administrators' arms, are looking at this, seeing what the future holds, and starting to say, okay, how could we become an APM? How could we pull this sort of thing off? All right? What I personally believe, now you have to understand, I'm one of the guys inside Intermountain who argues that we can work with people by partnership and that we don't have to employ physicians, which is a legitimate view within my system. I think when this kind of thing happens, though, it makes it much harder to be a private practice, is what I think happens. I want you to know, though, guys, it was the government doing it. And frankly, they're doing it to all of us, in all honest truth. Now, lest it seem too discouraging, I'd like to put a little different view on it, too, if I could. What's happening out there is this capitation's making a comeback. The government first really started to play it out in what was called the Pioneer ACO movement. They actually, in the legislation or the regulation that they proposed, had a series of steps that they wanted to move the profession through, the care delivery system through. It started with quality and cost metric reporting only. It was mandatory. It's a PQRS today. It's similar measures for hospitals. It's actually a little bit burdensome. They moved on to what's called value-based purchasing or pay-for-performance, so we have that running full blast too. And the Medicare Shared Savings Program has actually been fairly high rate of uptake by various physician groups. It's upside-only shared savings as you start to manage care, coordinate care more tightly. Their next step was upside plus downside in Medicare Shared Savings. There's another form of that that's called bundled payment. So that's the one that they just started for hips and knees. They did it as a trial, so they mandated that a randomly selected subset of hospitals in the United States would move to full bundled payment. Bundled payment is a DRG system with one big difference. It also includes all physician fees in the DRG. So all of the payments for the facility side and all of the payments for the physicians are bundled into one. And in addition to that, it uses a longer time period, typically a 90-day follow-up time window for any associated complications or problems the patient has as part of the single bundled payment. I know in the Intermountain system, we had four hospitals that were selected and mandated to be part of that. All right, and other hospitals in Utah were designated too. You need to know that in theory, in June, they're going to launch a more broadly applicable bundled payment system for heart failure and ischemic heart disease. This one is much more technically difficult. The details are as yet unknown, and it's going to be really interesting how they think they're going to pull that one off. Now, that is actually something we call disease capitation. When you start to identify major chronic diseases, you pay the practice a capitated payment for that patient in total based upon their burden of chronic diseases. And again, it will come out as a mandate on the hospital side initially, I believe. And I think it's going to hit about 50% of all hospitals in the country. They will run it as a trial where they're going to select the hospitals randomly so that they can measure its impact as an experiment over time. What they're trying to do is control the cost of Medicare. So we're back to where we started with the financial reality that they're facing. That's what they're trying to do with this thing. And finally, full capitation. You're familiar with that. You're basically an insurance company where you receive an insurance premium for each payment patient And then you deliver all necessary services and coordinate all necessary services along the way. Well, a question for you, a little bit of background. What determines a person's health? What are the most important things in determining how long and how well a human being will live? Genetics is actually number two. Lifestyle, there we go. The term that was used in the initial studies of this was behaviors. The last best summary work came from a surgeon who's now at IOM called Mike McGinnis, great guy. But there's a surprisingly rich literature around this thing. About 40%, Mike says, of a patient's total health depends upon behaviors. AMA report some years ago listed the main sources of loss of human life to behaviors. Number one was tobacco. In the initial report, number two was alcohol and other recreational drugs. So this is the CDC saying 98,000 preventable deaths each year from alcohol abuse. It's not just alcoholism, drunk driving. So 70% of all domestic violence is alcohol related. 75% of all violent crime, including murder, is alcohol related. They pulled in those things too. Number three, Joe Andrade at the University of Utah calls it movement deficit disorder, MDD. I suffer from it personally. I'd much rather fess up to that medicalized condition that I'm just too dang fat and don't get enough exercise. It's diet and exercise, it's obesity. And that's probably moving into number two. Doesn't make much difference what order they're in. Number four is sexually transmitted disease, including AIDS. Number five is unwed pregnancy. We used to say teenage pregnancy. It's pregnancy without an adequate social support network. Most of the harm comes in the life of the neonate. All right? But now we see in some of our low socioeconomic status populations, I think in African Americans, 70% unwed pregnancy rate. Hispanic populations up over 40%. Wait, 40% is the average for the country. And there are some real health consequences associated with that, as it turns out. Number six, suicide, violence, and accidents, particularly among young men. Now, the next big category is genetics. It's about 30%. The joke is how wise you are in selecting your parents. We're starting to make some real inroads into this, and I anticipate in the next few years we'll have some genetic interventions that are widely available that can make some real differences. Just in passing, there's some really nice stuff kind of hanging on the horizon, coming down the research pike on this. It'll be really nice, I think. Turns out about 20% is the physical environment, social networks, which turn out to be quite important, and public health. This grand enterprise of which we're a part, healthcare delivery, is at best about 10%. All right? So that's what the research literature shows. In fact, if I get really rigorous, if I put on my green visor and sharpen my pencils and demand hard evidence, maybe 5%. On the other hand, that's 3.5 to 7 years of life expectancy on average for every member of U.S. society. We do a world of good. There are some things that could do a lot more good. Now, this leads to a particular way of thinking about healthcare delivery. And I've tried to illustrate it here. What I've done is taken those categories, reordered them a bit. They're in the center of the slide. So up at the top, the 20%, physical environment, social networks, public health, 20% of care. And then below it, I have put personal health behaviors. There's a reason for this. I'll come to it in a minute. That's the 40%. And then you drop into the care delivery system. I would argue that what we really do in care delivery is disease treatment, by and large. I'm not sure we should call it the healthcare system or the disease treatment system. It's mostly the disease treatment system, you see. Now, the way to think about this, we used to call it continuum of care. As a process scientist, I would call it processes of care. Patient comes to us with a problem, type 2 diabetes mellitus, right? New onset depression. Think of that as a line running down through that stack. Now, the top part we call population health, as I've labeled it on the slide. So at a population level with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, you try to prevent it. You know, better eating and exercise behaviors, reduce obesity, reduce your type 2 diabetes rates in the community. So you try prevention, you have basically detection screening programs to find it when it does occur. Then you drop into the care management piece at the bottom, and across that continuum of care, you manage it. Primary care feeding, secondary care feeding, hospital and emergency department care, and finally to some sort of end state. I've said end of life on the slide. Some of them, of course, are not end of life when you come to the end state of a disease process. But think of that as a continuum of care. I served on the IOM committee where we popularized the term patient-centered care. And this is what we actually meant. What if you organize the care delivery system not around the physicians, which is the most common way, not around the technologies, the second most common way, not around the buildings, like a hospital, the third most common way. What if you organize it around the patient? You see? And it lends itself to this kind of a thought. We call them, in that context, move upstream strategies. That's what the government's looking for. Move upstream strategies is what they had in mind. Sometimes we call it hot spotting. A nice little white paper, three major subcategories. One way is you could look at a population of patients. Imagine you're capitated for a population of patients. You take a look at those people. You can identify the high utilizers, the people who are currently using medical services heavily. And many times you can intervene and fairly dramatically reduce their care delivery rates by reducing their need. Turns out it's higher quality, reducing the cost of care. A second way you could predictively model to identify future high utilizers. One of the things that we're currently doing through my office, we have a little tool put together by David Eddy. When David was at Stanford, he invented evidence-based medicine, basically, and the methods we use for it. All right? And he's built this system that goes out and analyzes patients. It's far more accurate than a Framingham model or any other modeling system. To say, okay, who in this population is likely to have a heart attack or stroke in the next 5 years, or 2 years, or 1 year? See, that's predictive analytics. And you can identify patients who are at high probability of having a major medical event. And the idea is you get up front of it. You move upstream from it. You call those people in and get them going on a statin. And we actually now have a series of big trials that show that this is quite effective. You can reduce heart attack rates in a population. You can reduce stroke rates. And lastly, the big heavy there, population-level healthy behavior interventions. I'm not sure how good we are at that, at actually getting people to exercise and eat wisely, those sorts of things. But you have to include it on the list. Can I show you an example of it? Some years ago, we started to launch patient-centered medical homes inside Intermountain about 15 years ago. We're currently at Generation 3. Generation one was putting care management nurses in a primary care practice, backing them up with good clinical decision support for major chronic diseases like heart failure, diabetes, hypertension, depression, you see, and having them manage those patients even if they didn't come into the office. Identify the people who should be pulled in. What we showed were some fairly dramatic improvements in mortality rates and some fairly significant declines in hospitalization rates, and mostly because of the reduced hospitalization rates, declines in cost of care. You got out in front of these people so they didn't need the hospitalizations. It's a basic idea. Level two is when Brenda Reese Brennan introduced mental health integration for depression primarily. Same sort of a deal. Now, with level one, we had to put care management nurses in the clinics despite the fact that nobody would pay us for them. They were just part of the operations of the clinic. Additional burden on the clinic. The same thing happened with Brenda's approach. Now we had to put psychologists in there, shoulder to shoulder with the care management nurses. Nobody would pay us for them. But it was associated with a rather significant decline in overall medical usage. For each patient, I actually saved $900 per patient per year compared to not managing their depression well overall. All right? Level three, we've added social workers and geriatricians, so you can coordinate social services out in the community. Well, we're just finishing up a trial, Truth in Advertising. I think that JAMA is going to publish this for us. We've been going back and forth with them a little bit. I think we finally have it to the form they want. Now, I'm not showing you the clinical outcomes. It was associated with measurable improvements in clinical outcomes. This is just the cost outcome. Imagine that you're running an APM. All right, an alternative payment method, aka some form of capitation for some significant portion of your practice. Yeah, this suddenly may look really attractive. What we showed is in that Gen 3 medical home, emergency room visits declined by 11%, hospital admits declined by 22%. That's serious money right there. avoidable, other avoidable visits and admissions besides those two categories declined by 21. Now, not surprisingly, visits to physicians' offices, primary care offices, went up a tick, about 4%. Urgent cares, let's walk in primary care, that went up as you would expect. Things like radiology, other lab testing fell by about 11%. When you total the whole thing out, it cost Intermountain $22 per person per year to deploy the infrastructure of the medical home. This is across about 50,000 patients in a trial. Oh, the net total cost savings was $115 per patient in total medical spend. Had about a 5-to-1 return on investment. That's what we're seeing out there. A classic example, Hill Physicians in Northern California. IPA model, a bunch of primary care physicians who were really good at this stuff. They were capitated and they were making a killing. Most of the money they were making was by avoiding hospitalization through better care. They were showing rather significant declines in total payments by getting upfront, upstream on these patients, delivering more highly coordinated, better care. Now, the thing you need to know, best we can tell, well, Ed Deming, father of quality improvement theory, would have labeled that waste, and he had a generic model for measuring waste. This year, the United States is going to spend $3.2 trillion on healthcare delivery in this country. $3.2 trillion, $3,200 billion, $320,000 million. Served on the IOM committee where we had fairly rigorous evaluations, we said a minimum of 35% of that spend is waste, of the sort that I've just been describing, a minimum of 35%. We actually believed it was somewhere north of 50%. Well, wait a minute, 50% of $3.2 trillion, that's $1.6 trillion. And a good APM can tap in to those savings. Here's the crazy thing, its financial upside is dramatically higher than adding another service to your practice, right? Expanding revenues under a fee-for-service system. This thing has a very impressive financial upside for someone who is competent to coordinate and manage care. You see? Now, I won't go through the full details of a little clinical model. Under fee-for-service payment, the short version is, if you do those things, you create windfall savings for insurers. And I've got lots of examples of exactly that happening to Intermountain to the tune of $5 million a pop, where we ran a big clinical improvement project, eliminated waste through better care, showed dramatic cost declines, and we got nailed financially. We lost money. I mean, we're committed to patient care. Where do you get the funding for your next project when you're trying to scrape up $5 million in lost operating margin? You see? What this little slide right here shows is how different types of waste link to different kinds of payment systems. What you need to pay attention to is that right-hand column. By the way, the green up triangles means that the care delivery group who made the change, who coordinated the care, who improved the quality, they get the financial benefits. The practice who made it happen gets the financial benefits. The little red down arrows, that means that when you do that kind of better care and eliminate waste and save money, it means you're creating windfall savings for an insurer or for the government, for a payer, all right? There's only one column that's all up green arrows. I've labeled it provider at risk. It's what, in this plan, the government's calling APM. Another name for it's capitated. It has a fundamental difference from the HMO movement. Rather than having an insurance company in the middle, this is where a clinical care delivery group steps up and begins to coordinate and manage the care. I've argued for a long time that the HMOs were hopeless to begin with. They don't deliver any care. And that the only way this thing ever made sense is if the physicians and nurses who delivered the care were coordinating and managed the care. Managed care only makes sense in the hands of a clinical team. If you see that idea. And guys, it makes a lot of sense. Now the truth is, as many of you are moving down this road vigorously. When we figured this out, well, Intermountain as a system is actively seeking capitation. The reason is with our physician partners, we're able to manage care. Currently, about 35%, a little more than that, of all care delivered in the Intermountain system is capitated. We get a per member per month payment, an insurance premium for those patients. Yeah, a few years ago, Bert Zimmerle, Intermountain CFO, set a goal for the system. He made an interesting point. He said, look, we're all into quality care. He said, the trouble is if people don't have access to care, quality is meaningless. And he says, the rate of increase of health care costs is making health care less accessible to more and more people. He said, quality depends on accessibility, and accessible means affordable. So he set a goal for our system that we would keep our rate increases to patients at a maximum of consumer price index inflation plus 1%. He doesn't want me to say GDP minus 2. It means you bent the cost curve and the cost of healthcare, despite population increases, new technologies, baby boom, the whole thing, the cost of healthcare shrinks as a proportion of the total national wealth. It goes down, not up. Well, we modeled it out. Now, you have to remember, the population of the state of Utah is growing right now, right? So larger populations, baby boom demographic shifts, there are some others around obesity, new technologies. This is a conservative growth curve for Utah, as seen through Intermountain. It turns out to keep our services affordable to the people of this state, that's the line we had to hit. It meant as a system, we needed to take, at the end of this year, $730 million out of our cost of operations. That's 13%. Imagine it's your practice. How would you feel about taking 13% of your total cost of operations out of your practice? It looks scary to us. Here's the first 4 years. Through the end of 2015, we had taken $690 million. This is the finance department saying that this is accurate and true. I don't think they're complete, by the way. Out of Intermountain's cost of operations by improving care. Now, the tipping point for where you make more from waste elimination than you lose for the rest of your practice, it's still fee for service or per case. We're at 35%. We mathematically modeled that, and we did empiric models too. It's right around 25%. If 25% of your practice you're at financial risk, you do better financially to manage care than to try to enhance revenues. They're hard to do at the same time, all right? We have had some of the finest financial years we've had in the history of Intermountain in terms of operating margins, while taking $690 million so far out of our cost of our operations. Now, I have a short answer to this one, guys. What I tell my colleagues at home is I say, guys, 13%, pretty good start. I think the waste is over 50%. 13% is a good start. And you saw where this ended up. Last fall, we released a new insurance plan to employers in Utah where we guaranteed for the next 3 years a maximum year-over-year rate increase of 4%. We think that will be half to a third of what the rest of the market is capable of doing. We're taking that money and giving it back to the patients as more accessible health care, cheaper, affordable health care, you see. We did insist that those employers agree to play the same game. They have to deploy programs to their employees and their families to control their diet and exercise, or at least try to control their tobacco use, to control their alcohol use, all of those behavioral factors. A move upstream strategy around best health matches our mission. You see the idea? Here's what I really wanted to say to you. The financial circumstances are dire. The fact is, we have a glorious future in our hands. I was trying to show you the mechanisms by which a thoughtful physician practice, probably it'll take a group, can do very, very well by doing good. By honoring our professional commitments, by improving our care to our patients, and the structures that are emerging, some practices are going to do very well indeed. And the methods and techniques are there. So, I had a fun time running down the federal government. I kind of do that as a matter of principle. I figure they deserve it. On the other hand, I have to find myself representing Intermountain saying, please, please don't throw me into that briar patch. When what I really want to be is right in the middle of the briar patch. What Intermountain is planning to do, by the way, a number of you participate in it with us in our population health initiatives. So you're getting some of the financial upsides too out of this thing. We're seeing if we can get more of the federal spend to to come to us through capitated methods. The truth is looking at the federal government's problems, you want to get as far away from them as you possibly can financially. And if you're going to continue to treat Medicare and Medicaid patients, the only way you're going to do that is through capitation. So that was a technical talk. I hope I ended on a fairly upscale note. I honestly believe our profession has a glorious future, but that future will come through health professionals better serving our patients, improving clinical outcomes, eliminating waste, and creating a new clinical world. So with that, thanks for your time and attention. And I'm going to quit. Heck of a send-off for a glorious weekend, I hope, right? Turns out tort reform has a very, very small influence, if any. And by the way, there are more clever ways to handle tort reform, I would argue. That tort reform system is an abomination in terms of how it serves patients who have need. It's an absolute abomination, and that's where you get better leverage out of the thing. It's one of the least effective social systems in the United States or in the world today. It's an abomination. Yeah, it's a relatively small hit, 3%. Yeah. In looking at it, I honestly believe that you're going to be forced to group up. Now, we're going to continue to partner with group practices, you know, but I think that it's going to be really hard for somebody all on their own to make a go of this. The systems it requires makes it really hard. That's my judgment. Somebody's going to prove me wrong, by the way, and do it really well, I hope and I believe. But my basic guess is you'll be forced to partner up. So, you know, a group practice of some sort. It doesn't have to be Intermountain, but I bet you'll end up in a group practice, and I bet you'll end up partnering with groups like Intermountain. Yeah. Well, let me give you a couple of examples of where it's at. One of my favorites. One of the things we know, modern medicine, the rate of increase of new medical knowledge is so great, we have actually solid evidence that it exceeds the capacity of the unaided expert mind, is how we say it. And yet, in so much of clinical practice, we're required to do it from memory. We load the information and try to apply it to patients from memory. So this is Don LePay in our cardiovascular clinical program. They were looking at cardiac procedures. So this would be catheterization, stents, implantable pacemakers, and defibrillators. We already have one of the lowest use rates in the United States on a risk-adjusted population basis, by the way. But what LePay did, he actually used this to get away from the insurance companies and their pre-auth systems, was one of his primary targets. He just prepared through the ACC, American College of Cardiology, their indications for those procedures, and he set it up so the cardiologist just has to check off an indication, and that counts for pre-auth, so as opposed to the other crap we have to do with pre-auth. What he was doing, though, is getting the evidence in front of the decision maker, the solid evidence, at the point in time they were making the decision. They showed almost a 25% decline in use rates in already high-performing groups. It was a little sobering. It implied that we were treating some patients where the potential benefit was very small compared to the risk. By the way, they were tracking clinical outcomes. Clinical outcomes went up a little bit, not much, but a little bit. Slightly better clinical outcomes. That was $30 million a year in savings. Now, you do realize under current Medicare payment, if I'm paid per case, I just nailed my operating margins. I just nailed my budgets. If I'm capitated, ooh, that looks kind of sweet. Well, it's not rationing. When it's something that's not beneficial to the patient, it's not rationing. Or if I can move upstream like that third generation medical home does, right? Get out in front of it so that our complex diabetic patients, their hospitalization rates at 2 years fell from 39% to 31% through better primary care. And that was another $20 million a year. You see, that's not rationing. That's better care. Of course not. Hey, they'd be trying to tell me how much I can eat, or you how much you can eat. It's not going to happen. But on the other hand, you can influence that by working closely with patients, right? We're done. Thank you.